Good evening, everybody. James McKinney here with my Science Hour, 24th of February, 2022. A lot of topics to cover tonight, and this is the last week I will be talking about the 1970s in my ongoing series, this entire year talking about my history of discoveries. And what's important in the 1970s and before, in my college years, etc., is the preparation that I went through, not only book learning, so to speak, but all kinds of things that happened to me, the archaeology events in Mexico, Central America, understanding the importance of Venus as opposed to other, why not the sun? The Greeks were big on the sun and the moon, etc. But the Greeks, you see, came afterwards. The Mayans were still reflecting on the early days, the 1500 BC days, which they were still carrying on the traditions. But learning this and having it there so that when these details came around, I could put it into perspective. And so what I'm going to do this week is I'm going to put out a number of bullet points, and actually quite a few, dozens of them, which are the things that I had prepared mentally and the theoretical models, etc., that I had ready by the time I hit Cornell in 1979, the fall of 1979. But first of all, I want to talk about a couple things, and the very first one is being a carpenter. Now, I've talked about going out into the wilderness alone, spending time by myself, extended periods of times. And there's something, too, that I realize when you look at, say, prophets or people who take time out of their life to go into the wilderness. What's the wilderness? It's a place where there's nobody else is pretty much the wilderness. Could be a desert. It could be a forest. It could be the jungle, etc. But the idea is that you are out there by yourself. That's where you get a hold of things. That's where you get a hold of yourself. And I've had a lot of people tell me, that they couldn't do that themselves. And I understand that. This is not for everybody. It's not easy, believe me, for going months and months at a time by yourself. It's not easy. But the first thing I wanted to mention, and then, the thought I had here was that when they talk about, for example, in the Bible, 40 days and 40 nights, so, the Noah's flood went for 40 days and 40 nights. Does that mean it was 40 days, not 41 or 39, but 40? Or when they said that Christ went out into the wilderness, into the desert for 40 days and 40 nights, does that mean it was 40 days and not 41 or 39 or any other number? No, that was a way of talking about many in a long time. In other words, such a long time that you forgot. You lost track of time. You lost track of how long you were gone. And I've had people say to me, because they wanted to do something like what I did and go out into the wilderness and by themselves, and they go, do you think a month is enough time? And it's like, wow. If you have to ask that question, you don't understand the process, the mental process. And the fasting and the cleansing of your body, drinking water from a pure source day after day, and literally cleaning your body out to where it's the way it's supposed to be, not full of preservatives and junk food and everything else you have in modern society. And just a story, one time, this was after I was at Cornell, I came back and I went to the up north and into the Canadian wilderness for many, many months, from about June, probably late May, June or something like that. And then I came back in February. That's how long I was gone, on an extended canoe trip. And then the summer went into fall and the fall went into winter, and I just stayed there. I had my clothes, I had my my gear, but I had no tent. I didn't build a roof. I slept outside. I existed outside, and I talk about that. But that was, that was a period of many, many months, certainly a lot more than 40 days. So my point is, when they talk about Noah's flood, 40 days and 40 nights, or when they talk about Christ going into the desert for 40 days, that's a relative number. It's like long enough to where you don't remember when you left society, so to speak, or civilization, and you went out on your own. And so if you have to ask the question, would a month be enough or would 2 months be enough, then you got the whole wrong idea. I just want to mention something else that I spent a lot of time doing, woodworking. Now, I just started this when I was a kid with crude tools. I didn't have really nice tools or anything, but I loved wood. I loved working with wood. And so that grew into small projects, into bigger projects, into quite large projects, projects that would take many, many months, like 9 or 10 months to complete, or in some cases, a number of years, coming back for 2 or 3 months at a time to work on a project, then leaving for maybe another 8, 9 months, and then coming back for another 3 to 4 months working on a project in many years, but working with wood. And there's something, it's interesting, for example, Christ's father, Joseph, or his stepfather, you should say, was a carpenter. And I think it's very important to understand the, and when Christ was little, he was a carpenter's assistant. He was learning carpentry. And there's something about working with wood that really, it's very, I don't know what you would call it. It connects you into the universe. And I've always told this to people too, that if you live in a city and everything is organized and all the streets are up and down and it's 90 degrees and all the buildings are perfectly straight up, that environment, you go into the buildings and there's square walls and everything, is might be nice. You might live in a very nice place or you might not. But at any rate, it's not conducive to really connecting with who you are. You have to get out into the wilderness where there's irregularities. The rocks are not cut neatly and piled up. They're all scattered all over from who knows how they got there. The trees are all different sizes and different shapes, and some are falling over and rotting, and some are just starting out fresh sprouts. But the nature itself is very irregular, just like looking up into the stars. They're very irregular. They're not all in one spot in nice little rows and columns. So nature itself has a lot of irregularities, asymmetries, not even symmetries, not even asymmetries, just irregularities in it. And there's something about that, that when you live in that natural environment, it changes your attitude. That's why people that live in cities get regimented. They make all these rules. They got to do everything like this. Everything is in order. And they've forgotten the purpose of life. They've forgotten about it. So anyway, I wanted to mention extensive amount of time that I spent, and I'm not going to go into specifics of what I did in woodworking, but working with wood, I think, is a very important aspect of getting a hold of who you are, etc. And I think a lot of these things in the, for example, in the Bible, you find that people were carpenters. Noah was a carpenter. He worked with wood. And so it's very important. I think it's a way of telling you subtly that work with wood. It's good for you. It's good therapy. Okay, I want to talk about the following topics and put them together. There are such things as talents. Talents are things that you naturally have. There are people that are natural singers that just come up to a song and belt it out and you know everybody's crying, or everybody's laughing, or everybody feels emotional. You know, that's a talent. That's something that's like you have it and other people don't. You know, other people might have different degrees of talent, but you have your own specific talent. And it might be, in my case, with physics and mathematics. Clearly, I have talent in that aspect. But it's not just talent. If you have talent and don't develop it, then it's like a seed that's planted that doesn't have fertilizer and water. It doesn't grow well. Anyway, skill, I'm going to list a number of things. Talent, skill, discipline, practice, concentration, connection to the universe, that is your spiritual and mental connection to the universe, understanding that, getting the like the vibes, so to speak. That's kind of a modernistic term, but the vibes. And also spiritual strength, that is understanding that in life, when you do something, you're going to be attacked. sometimes viciously, sometimes personally. And you have to stand up to this, especially if you know what you're doing. You have to withstand this onslaught that comes a lot of times from on high. And people in authority, people that have a lot more sway on the world than you do. So at any rate, talent, skill, discipline, practice, concentration, spiritual strength, and connection to the universe. So anyway, these are things that a lot of times sports develops. And a lot of times sports, when you see people in the Olympics, a lot of times they're pushed to the point where they're like disturbed emotionally because they're under such pressure to succeed. They're at that fine point when just missing a little thing could mean the difference between gold medal and silver medal. When you're up at that point, or tennis, or golf, or any of these sports, you know, any of the sports, when you're up at that level, the difference between the top person and the second person a lot of times is very little, and a lot of times it's a matter of luck even. But the reason I'm mentioning this is because when I first got to college, I said, okay, now I'm away from all of the influences, you know, the family life, everything else that went on. I said, I'm gonna take some time here, and, you know, while I'm studying physics and math and doing my coursework, etc., I'm going to take some time and I'm going to break down everything that I think is true, and then I'm going to rebuild it and think it through. And so I started doing that, and that's where, as a person, you become an adult, and you have to become your own person. And so anyway, that's a point at which you have to identify your talents, develop your skills with those talents, because you could have a person with a lot less talent, but if they develop their skill with discipline and practice, they could become much better at something than a person with a lot of talent. So at any rate, the reason I'm mentioning this is, and if there are young people listening also, look at what your talents are. Look at what you like to do. Develop your skills. Sometimes you won't know why you're developing a particular skill or talent, but it's going to lead to something else you're going to need someday. And you don't know what that is. Okay, so now, as promised, I'm going to set about talking a number of bullet points, probably a few dozen of them here. Just also, this actually came out recently, where people are talking about the corruption in the funding of Ivy League schools. And so what happened was that they are receiving far more money from federal funding than they are from tuition. So they're not about school. And I learned that when I was at Cornell. It was not about education. In fact, I'll be quite frank with you, my small college, 9 physics majors in our entire class, liberal arts college with very dedicated professors, was far better than what I saw at Cornell for the undergraduates. And of course, the graduate situation is totally different. But they're also part of this monster system where the grad students are teaching the problem sessions and doing laboratory work and things like that. But what this recent study showed was that Ivy League schools in general, in fact, there's a person that's what they're doing is studying government funding in general, and they came across these statistics. And what their goal is to document all government spending at all levels of government, state, federal, local, etc. And what they discovered, then they go into some of these side industries, like just for example, the Ivy League schools. And you could also qualify this for the Western schools, the California school systems, university systems, etc. And for example, the Ivy League schools, I think there's 9 or are there 10 of them together, have a annual contribution of about $44 billion. That's with a B, billion. And thank you, Carl Sagan, who was billions and billions, was his famous line. He was people joke about that, which is funny because he did kind of rely on that to accentuate large things, billions and billions of stars or whatever. But the in terms of money, Cornell was getting huge amounts of money, much more than they were taking in from tuition. And so, and plus their endowment. So here were the actual numbers. $44 billion a year the Ivy League schools take in as grant money. So this is money that the professors get, that other research people at the university get. And these people don't teach. They don't teach in a class. Carl Sagan would teach one undergraduate astronomy class, and there was a tremendous vying for getting into those classes by the students. And then the parents would, oh, my son was taught by Carl Sagan at Cornell. And I will add something here, that if you took my degree from my college and compared it, if you went in for job interviews or something and compared it to a Cornell degree of four-year physics, etc., the Cornell degree would rank much higher. There's no question about it. But did they get a better education? In reality, no. They're paying for that degree. And my first assignment when I was at Cornell in the physics department was in the electronics. I was in an electronics course. And one of my jobs as part of that course was to arrange the laboratory equipment for, it was like a second level electronics course. These are would be physics majors, and their job was to come in and do their lab and spend 2 hours. It was like cookie cutter. And so they had a little bin, and when you came into this kind of like big room, the all of the laboratories, there would be like, say, 10 sets of the exact same laboratory experiment, all in bins. And all the wires were cut, all the circuit boards were there, whatever it was, if they needed transistors or resistors or rheostats, whatever the components were, they had to have there. And when they came in, they would plug in the wires. It would be the red wire goes here, the blue wire goes here. They would not know why it was a certain gauge of wire, or why it was cut to a certain length, or why the rheostat was connected the way it was. None of this. They just like, here's the diagram, plug this all together, take your measurements, and put everything back in the box. And my job as part of this electronics course was to maintain all this equipment and make sure it was all working properly. And if the students had an issue during the lab, they'd say, well, this isn't working. I'd have to quick go get a replacement part or something like that. And that was part of my job for this electronics class. And also I was doing some other work in other classes. When I got to the math department, I was teaching calculus. And so anyway, the bottom line is that my education, when I was in college, we had a full-time machinist that worked in a shop, a really nice shop with big equipment, and we literally made our experiments. So when we had a rheostat, we had to go find rheostats that were the proper, ohmage and resistance, and we had to find the wires that were appropriate to carry the current necessary, and we had to locate them and strip the wires off and connect them and put on the connectors. We had to do everything. And so in terms of comparison, I think you might be able to see that the Cornell experience was far inferior to what I got. And this was through 4 years of school. Also, when the students got done with class, they left. They all went home. When we got done with class or experiments or whatever we were doing, we all stayed in the physics building. All of the physics students lived in the physics building a lot of the time. And so we had that camaraderie. Plus, a great benefit was having the upperclassmen there also. There was a library, a physics library, at the end of the hall. And when I had an issue and I couldn't understand something, I'd go down and one of the upperclassmen would walk me through it or say this. And we got a tremendous amount of cooperation from the other students. And, of course, if the students couldn't help you, you had the professors that were right there also all the time. and a lot of them actually lived on campus. So they were there, and they were there early in the morning, working late at night. To the contrary, most professors at Cornell, if they taught a class, mainly those would be people working for tenure. The tenured people would be off in research land getting, and that's your ticket to ride there, by the way. If you don't get grant money, then you are not going to be there. It was a bit different when I was at Tulane. There were people who did not have vast amounts of grant money. My advisor at Tulane had a lot of money coming in, and he had various programs going on, but some of the other professors did not, and they were perfectly fine. But at Cornell, if you were at tenure, the last thing on your mind was teaching that class. And these people would come in, and they would write on the board. They'd turn their back to the students, and when they got done filling the board up, they'd walk out because their intention was not to teach. Their intention was to get back to their research because they needed to get grant money, which at that level is pretty competitive, and a lot of them washed out. A lot of them did not get that research money, and here they got a wife and some kids, little kids, and they're, you know, they've gotten through their postdoc. They've starved. Their family has starved for years. Now they've got a position at Cornell, and it's highly competitive to get that grant money, especially when you're a peon, like a postdoc type of position or a pre-tenure position. And so you got to really work full time. I mean, it is, you don't see your family. It's a really, really a bad system. But these people don't teach. And in fact, this one experience I had when I was at Cornell, I went, one of the professors had a family issue in the calculus class, and I was teaching calculus, and so they asked me if I could take over his calculus sessions. And so I said, okay. So I go into the classroom, and this is 395 students in a classroom. And this is like, these guys are paying $65,000 a year for tuition. This is in 1979 money. My goodness, I don't know what it is now. But anyway, 395 students in a classroom, and I walk in, and there's a great big chemistry desk. So this would have been like a chemistry lab for, teaching. And then it had a blackboard that was literally 90 feet long. I measured it. And so I came in and I started here's the lesson of the day, the textbook, etc. It was the same textbook I was using for my own classes of calculus there. And so I start the lecture and I start talking, and I'm about 20 seconds into it, and this guy yells from about the fifth row up. He says, "We don't understand limits," because I'm talking about limits, and we're already well into this course of calculus. And I turned around and I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah, we don't know anything. This guy comes in and he writes on the board and he mumbles and he walks out. We haven't learned anything." And another guy pipes up, and then a young lady way up in the upper classroom yells out similar thing, and they're like, "Yeah, he's not teaching us anything. We don't know anything." And I'm like, "What?" So I came around to the front of the room, and I'm like, "Wow, you guys have been in this class for a month or more now and have not learned anything." So I sat up on a desk with my feet hanging down loose, because it was a very high, one of these big old chemistry desks that covered the whole front of the room. And I sat up on that thing, and I talked with my hands, and I talked them all the way through the first chapters, talking about limits and Riemann limits and Cauchy limits and all the different types of limits, etc. And brought them up to speed on what limits were all about, and up to differential calculus, etc. And I got done. And so anyway, I took this guy's class for quite a while. He was gone. He had some kind of family issue. He had to go back. And so I had his class for quite a while, and when he came back, the students went over and signed a petition, 395 signatures, and I eventually saw that petition. I didn't know this happened. When it happened, I didn't know this. And the head of the math department did not, their petition was that I would continue teaching their calculus class. And, of course, they had their schedule set up in the math department. So this professor came in and continued teaching. At the end of my second year there, 1981 spring session, I was called, this is deep into the springtime, almost at the end of the session, I was called into the math department chairman's office. Wolfgang Fuchs, a very nice, wonderfully great mathematician, he called me in to his office, and this is when I saw this petition. It wasn't when the students took it over to his office, and he kept it on file there, and he says, James, I don't know what to do with you. He said, your teaching is great, the students love you, you are publishing in peer-reviewed astrophysics journals. Nobody in the history of the Department of Mathematics at Cornell has ever, all of the professors over, 100 years or more, nobody has ever published in a peer-reviewed astrophysics journal, and you have. It's amazing. He was amazed that I had done this, had accomplished this, using Cornell's name, Department of Mathematics, so that was, a big honor. And he said, your teaching is great, the students love you, and he said, here, this is the petition the students brought to me from that class you took over. And I looked down, and there were like notebook pages ripped out of notebooks with 395 names on it requesting that I teach the mathematics course for these students. He said, look at this. He said, the students love you, but they want me to fire you. I'm like, what? And this is the same routine I had gotten in the physics department. The astronomy department came over and wanted me out of there. And so, and eventually he was pressured to let me go with those qualifications. And if I would have stayed there, I probably would be a tenured professor by now, by a long time ago. That was 1981. So count the years, count the decades. Anyway, my point is, now the statistics of this study regarding Cornell and the Ivy League schools in general is they had an endowment of $140 billion total. Sum up, all of them have these large endowments. An endowment is money that's been given to them by alumni or other donors or foundations, etc., just given to them. And they put it in the bank. Basically, they have investments, etc., and there are people that manage those massive endowments. So they have all this money sitting there, $140 billion. They get $44 billion a year, collectively, Ivy League schools, from the federal government in grant money, and they only take in about $35 billion total in tuition. You can see this is a business. And so what am I doing? I end up at Cornell. I start publishing papers using NASA data, proving NASA theories incorrect. And it was not too popular. So the other thing is this political machine that is top down. And so in on campus, what I did, I'll just tell this story as long as I'm talking about it. I challenged NASA on campus, so I wrote up a one single piece of paper, and I passed it around to all the faculty through intercampus mail. Every person on the faculty at Cornell got this, and I said, NASA is fudging data. They're they're trying to guard these old, outdated theories that don't make sense, and they're using their power to monopolize other departments like geology, the newly started archaeoastronomy department, etc., and so all of the other departments, the astrophysics, etc., had to come under the umbrella of this timeline of the Big Bang and the solar system started 4.5 billion years ago and nothing has happened since. All of these things had to fall under astronomy with Carl Sagan as king of the hill. And so anyway, I was challenging these people on campus, and I'll talk more about this when I get up to the Cornell years, which is, by the way, starting next week. I will be talking in more detail about this, but I'm just giving you a preview and talking about the fact that this location, Cornell University, Ivy League school, is a business, a massive business. And the science there is like golden, as Doug Fitchin told me when he basically told me I could not talk to students about my work. He wanted to fire me, but he couldn't. He needed me to teach. So he just muted me. I told that story before about Betty Richardson, Dr. Betty Richardson, following me around on campus so I would not talk to students. That's how paranoid they were of my work and publishing it in peer-reviewed journals, and told me I could not use Cornell's name anymore to publish my work, which was, you know, anyway, it's a long story. But these are industries. And when the industry is threatened, it reacts. And so the science that you're being presented is not about science. It's about that big, massive industry. And this is just a little teeny piece of the overall story, because then what Carl and these other NASA scientists at Cornell and, you know, UCLA and et cetera, that work at JPL and at Goddard and at NASA, et cetera, what they didn't know is they're tier two science. There's a whole layer of science above them of which they knew nothing. And so that's what I call the military science. And so anyway, it's important to understand this structure. And also, when I was defining the three tiers, the tier one, two, three, four layers of science, I forgot to mention something that grew out of this. Is the in tier three, the tier three scientists, which would be university professors or teachers of astronomy at the college level who do not do research. They don't get grant money. You know, that's tier three in my structure of science. Tier one, of course, being the military science you don't see. Tier two being the NASA, what most people consider top scientists. And then tier three, being the college professors. But out of tier three grew this in when we get up into the 1980s and early 90s and mid 90s, etc., when a lot of disinformation started coming out. NASA really sat back and never appeared. NASA never made any comments when we get up into the Planet X days and a lot of the intrigue, the Hale-Bopp days and all of that. NASA sat back and really didn't say anything. They had these outreach people that they paid under the table who looked like independent scientists who were there and who were basically defending the Reich, so to speak. You know, and I'm not going to name names here, but there were a lot of them. And there were internet trolls that literally worked as what they did, and they're still out there. What they did is they went around and they were constantly searching the internet. And any time, for example, my name would pop up, one of these trolls would be there trying to lambaste me and my name and, oh, McCanny is this and he's a crackpot and on and on and on. And they were there instantly. I was banned from YouTube long before anybody else even dreamt of being banned from YouTube. My name, if it appeared or my webpage link or anything, these people would jump on it immediately and remove it, and no reference to me was allowed on YouTube in the comment section or anything. It was completely banned. And also Wikipedia, which was taken over by the CIA, as was all of the social media, is owned in through these chains of command by the CIA. And Wikipedia started out as this honest, well, we can all contribute to knowledge. You can write your own information. That was taken over very early on. And the trolls were in there and still are, where they had originally a page on me where they slammed me and all kinds of things that were totally incorrect about me. All it did was drive traffic to my page, and I sold books. Because the people would get to my page and they'd go, oh, this is interesting. It's like Henry Ford used to say about advertising. He'd say anything you want about Ford, just say Ford. And it was kind of the same thing. I would get this onrush of traffic and people buying my books because when they got to my page, they had forgotten that all of the negative stuff they had written, they had read about me on Wikipedia. And they would say, well, this is interesting. I want to know more. And they would ask for, you know, they'd go buy my books. And so all they were doing was driving traffic to my webpage. So they actually took the webpage down. And now in basically, I don't exist on Wikipedia, which is pretty comical. But anyway, that's how paranoid they are of my information getting to the public because it's correct information. And as they say, you get the most flack when you're over the target. And so in the 1970s, going back to that 1970s era, as you know, I'm developing all of this, I'm totally unaware of the political bee's nest that I'm about to step into when I get to Cornell. Had no idea. I had not heard of Velikovsky. I didn't know about the Carl Sagan thing. And I'm just doing my research, which I had always done in private, worked always by myself, never worked with anybody else. The people I did work with, for example, the Russians, they were learning from me when the tier one scientists would come out from the military, etc., and talk to me, call me up on the phone. They were learning from me. They had problems they couldn't solve, and they'd say, here, we don't know what to do with this. We don't know how to. And I'd go, oh, yeah, well, that's this and this and this. And they were always the comment that they always sent back to me is, we don't know how you figure this. We don't know how you figured all this stuff out. And that's because I had the theoretical background. When you have a theoretical background, you can understand things. You can project. You can determine things because you have the theoretical background to answer questions. And so they could never figure out how I knew all of this. Well, it's because I had spent years and decades studying, and I knew how things really worked, the electrical nature of the solar system and universe. And so with that, I could make a lot of projections. And for example, in the when I got back from after Cornell, I was out in Los Angeles looking for funding for my electromagnetic propulsion system projects. Why did I do that? Why did I invent those things? Because I knew of the electric currents in outer space. If you didn't know about that, you certainly wouldn't invent an electromagnetic propulsion system. Why would you do that? Because you don't believe there are electric currents and in outer space. So anyway, those are just examples. But the point I wanted to make here, very important, is that Cornell and the Western schools, the California school systems, the ones that get the big money, are businesses. These are science businesses, science industries, massive in scale, and they have to march to a party line, and you cannot go out of that. You cannot sidestep that and upset the apple cart. It's only when you publish a paper in a peer-reviewed journal, it's only allowed that you add a little bit to all of the body of knowledge that already exists. That's a peer-reviewed published paper. And they're not going to allow something that comes in and totally upturns their entire apple cart of 100 years and more. Okay, so anyway, I've beaten this topic, but it's so important to understand putting this into context where my work comes along and literally changes everything. Not only changes it, but replaces it with theories that make a lot of sense. So anyway, what I'm going to do now is go through these talking points. And just one last issue here. When you're looking at Tier 1 science, Tier 1 science is what is owned by the bankers. These scientists once, and I've seen this happen, where a really good scientist, and I'd see them when I was at American Geophysical Union meetings or when I was at, say, invited talks like at Los Alamos, etc. I would see these really good scientists, and you could tell that they were a step above everybody else. But when you get to these schools, everybody's good. But there are some that just are like head and shoulders above the rest. And you go, now that's a person that's going to be a Tier 1 scientist someday. They're going to pluck that person out, and they're going to take them aside, and here, you got to sign these contracts. We're going to improve your salary. You know, your life is going to become much better. You're going to be a very important scientist, but you can't talk to anybody about anything you do. Anything from this point on in your life is top secret. And if you talk to anybody, we'll kill you and your family and anybody else you know. And so that's what they tell them. It's basically, you are owned. We own you and all of your work from here on in. And at that point, they typically say yes. There's a lot of incentives to do that. And of course, when you're a hungry, you know, tenured professor or NASA scientist, that's really a good invitation. That's really good bait, because that is, now you get to work with the good stuff, the good equipment. You get to take the, and here are stories too. People who work, say, up in the Haleakala in Hawaii, the really good military installations. And these are military scientists. And in the middle of the night, in would come a different group of people. They would all have to leave. And somebody else came in and took over their equipment for the night or for a series of nights. And they didn't know who these people were or where they came from or where they went. Those are the secret levels of science that go on. And so anyway, and that's the science that you will never see. When various presidents became president, they were going to get into the UFO issue. And what you're seeing now, disclosure. No. They're gonna disclose some phony baloney and make the geeks think that they're really getting a lot of information, and that's never going to happen. This tier one science, and it belongs to the bankers who own all of science. And why do they permit this tier two science, which is bogus science, why do they permit that to exist? Because that's what the public sees. And this goes back to the Middle Ages, when the Catholic Church would teach that the earth was flat. Why would they teach that the earth was flat when they all knew it was round? And Columbus knew it was round. All the mariners knew it was round. This goes back to the Greeks. The ancient Greeks knew the world was round. But they taught in the Middle Ages that the earth was flat, and that at the end of the earth, the water, where there was a big waterfall, the water flowed over the edge, there were fire-breathing dragons, there were huge storms, and if you went there, you would die. That's what they taught. And why would they do that? Because they wanted everybody sequestered mentally. And so they're doing that today. That's what I won't even go into details about today, but that's what everything you see today, these boogeyman after boogeyman after boogeyman in the news, are all meant to sequester you mentally. And there's one other little fun fact here that I want to mention in this discussion of owned and controlled science. And you would say, well, wow, they spend this massive amount of money on incorrect science. That doesn't make any sense. Well, it does if this controls all of the other information that is out there. And that's the way it is. And that was, you know, when the Carl Sagan did the Cosmos series. This was during the time I was at Cornell, 79 to 81. He was in Hollywood making the Cosmos series. And what that did is establish evolution of the solar system, of the planets, of the universe, and from the Big Bang, starting from the Big Bang, and the evolution of biological life, starting from 4.5 billion years ago, the Earth was formed from a ball of dust in the sky. And then all of a sudden, you know, 4 billion years later, you have people walking around. What could be wrong with that? But that's what he established, and he did it so graphically with walking on this map from the beginning of the earth and walked through time as the dinosaurs, etc. And in a sense, you know, nobody, who could prove him wrong? But on the contrary, who could prove him correct? Because this is just hand-waving. It's what we call a snow job in science. Somebody just presents all this information, and they have the authority, and therefore they're right. And that's what is happening. By simply edict of authority, And what's, if you look at the something called Masterclass now, which is a totally controlled, just like Wikipedia, it immediately became totally controlled by the CIA to put out misinformation. One of the very first Masterclasses was with the student of Carl Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson, who is, you know, the representative. He's taken over the Carl Sagan image of the authority in science. And he starts out by saying that we have all of this massive amount of information, which, by the way, you don't have access to, nor do any other independent scientists like McCanny. But he says that we have all this information, and therefore we're right and you're wrong. We're smart, you're dumb. And you just never have enough information to contradict what we're saying. That's how he leads off with this. In other words, they're right, and they're they cannot be challenged. They cannot be challenged on any level. But now this gets to the point of this little addendum that I'm putting on here, and it's about Nobel Prizes. Back in the day, back in the early 20s and the 30s, etc., there were real Nobel Prizes. And of course, everything in science is political when you get up at that level. It's not like sports. In sports, it's like if you're in a downhill slalom skier and somebody does better than you, that's because they did better. It's a physical fact. It's not political. It's not because your coach had more pull with the judges than somebody else. No, it's because you were physically better. And in science, it's not that way. It's political. But back in the early days when Einstein and other people were getting their Nobel Prizes, and by the way, Nikola Tesla never got a Nobel Prize. Isn't that interesting? But anyway, with all the amazing work that he did. But today, the Nobel Prize is completely political. And it has to do with the standardization of certain concepts. For the last 2 years, for example, the Nobel Prize has been given relative to climate change, which is the big public political football. They have to nail that. And before that, it was related to the Big Bang. And so, and one of them was actually illegal and most of them are illegal by the rules of the Nobel Committee. They gave it to a NASA group of scientists and the lead scientist on that project. It was the COBE satellite project, which was to look for the microwave background radiation with a satellite. But the rule is it has to go to an independent scientist who's doing independent research. And the COBE satellite is a government-funded project. And so that it has crept into this region where they're giving Nobel Prizes for people who are working on government work and being funded, etc. It's no longer the laboratory scientist working on his own, making discoveries. It is political. And so anyway, I just wanted to mention that because that's very important. So now, finally, after this long introduction, I'm going to get into the topic of bullet points on leading up to the what I call the Cornell years, which will start next week, the entire month of March, and I'll be doing 5 shows on the Cornell years. Very important. And I have the entire year planned out here for all of the shows leading up to the present day. Okay, so these are bullet points of things that I had ready in my pocket, in my theoretical pocket, by the time I got to Cornell in the fall of 1979. Okay, so this is the 1970s, pre-1979 topics that I had already had developed in my own work. Gravitational, electric, magnetic fields in outer space and how they work and how they interact. And I would like to, if I have time at the end of this show, talk about the point of view of, say, a molecule or a dust particle in outer space, and how they react to the various fields, gravitational, electric, magnetic fields. And so some of the subtleties that even good scientists, or allegedly good scientists, did not understand, I had a firm understanding. for example, that the electric fields had very little effect on anything bigger than a tennis ball. Okay, then that comets were becoming planets, that they would grow by this accumulation process. They get bigger, and the big ones could accumulate material in the cometary process and then become planets. So comets becoming planets and the theoretical structure of how that worked. The problem with redshift and also the bending of light around the sun and the orbit of Mercury, the precession of the orbit of Mercury, were physics problems that allegedly were solved by general relativity. But there were some major problems with general relativity in that it was only gravity that was affecting electromagnetic radiation. Well, so how did this happen? And this was Einstein's own criticism of general relativity. Of course, special relativity, the action of light in frames of reference, was known and proven, but general relativity, that elevator analogy, which I'll talk more about when in the future episodes, and I also talk about this, of course, in my books. By the way, you should all have read my books also, not depend on these lectures for my information. I'm not going to repeat what's in my books released to the general public. But there again, all of these issues with the redshift and bending of light around the sun and the induced electric dipole redshift, these are things that I had in my basket, so to speak, when I got to Cornell. When I saw the data, when I saw this data coming in data sessions at the end of the day, I said, that's it. That's the induced electric dipole redshift. I'm sitting around, but people, NASA scientists, who had no clue of what they were looking at. Also, spacecraft charging. So this is something that I understood because it was part of the same discharge process used by comets. Whenever you have a non-uniform electric field in outer space, then you also have the issue of discharging that and then the charging up to a negative potential very quickly. And that appears actually in my first published papers. And that's why it was important to establish that. For example, if you look in the Saturn paper, Saturn Sweeper Moon's paper, then Saturn Sweeper Moon predicted, it was one of my second peer-reviewed published paper. I make it clear in there that spacecraft charging is very important, and then the induced electric dipole redshift on metal spacecraft, and that a single spacecraft could not measure voltages in outer space. So here's a problem where you're looking for a voltages in outer space and looking for the reason for those voltages, and they're sending out single spacecraft. Well, let me take an example. If you go out and open the hood of your car and you look at the battery, and it's a 12-volt battery, and so you say, I want to measure the voltage on my battery. So you take out your ohm meter and you turn it to voltage and measurement, and you take the two probes and you put one, you put the red one on the positive one, you put the black one on the negative lead of the battery, and you measure the voltage. You need two leads to measure voltage. It's by definition a potential difference. It's an electrical potential difference. And so how can you measure voltage in outer space with a single spacecraft? You cannot do it. It's impossible. And so that's related also to spacecraft charging, because the spacecraft become charged up to a negative potential, so they will resist electrons hitting them and up to a certain point. And what happens then is they only allow equal numbers of protons and electrons to hit the spacecraft. So if you have a detector for electrons and protons on a spacecraft, you will always detect equal numbers, even though the spacecraft is charged and you're living in a voltage differential, you're living in an electrical potential universe, you will never be able to measure it with a single spacecraft. That's simple 101 physics, and I knew this. So when I got to Cornell and I see them proving that there's no voltages in outer space with a single spacecraft, I'm like, these guys are morons. They don't understand basic physics. And then I understood also as a little aside note, that when I started looking into the backgrounds of the space scientists, etc., and astronomers especially, they quit physics at maybe the second year of physics. They did not have good physics backgrounds at all. And so you're dealing with people that are propounding theories in outer space that don't have any physics background. How could this be? Well, that's the way it is. And they're very poor scientists with a big mouth and a big stick. Okay, so then on to charge pair production with the photons, and the fact that the photons had a charge pair in them. And this is basic. Once again, this is Nobel Prize winning work here, to understand that in pair production, the charged particles, the negative, the positron, and the electron are held within every photon. Every photon, no matter what its wavelength, has a charge pair. And if there's conversion between a photon and a charge pair, the mass is converted because of the energy conversion between the photon and mass. The mass conversion equals mc squared. But the charge pair, where did they come from? They were contained in the photon. So there is they don't just disappear into nothingness. The charges are conserved, and they're present in the photon. In an induced situation, they can separate, and that's what causes the redshift and the bending of light in an electromagnetic setting, and that's what Einstein was looking for and never found. And he was critical of general relativity in his book, his autobiography, Out of My Later Years. He criticizes general relativity openly because it did not include the total field. In other words, it did not include electromagnetism, electricity and magnetism, along with gravity. So why would gravity affect light, and we don't have any known effects from electromagnetism? And that's why he was very interested in Velikovsky. So interestingly enough, and of course, like I said, I'll repeat this, in the 1970s, I did not know who Velikovsky was. I never heard of him. And when I was at Cornell, I did not know who he was. So I wasn't like some people accuse me of trying to develop models to prove Velikovsky right. No, it's just that I was working totally independently, came to these conclusions that comets would become planets, etc., completely independently on my own. So then also the history of science, I did a lot of time, put in a lot of time studying the history of science, how all of this theoretical structure came to be. Okay, so then on to the core fusion model of the sun. I knew there was something wrong with that. And all of that solidified also when I was at Cornell. The ball lightning and the atmosphere model of fusion of the sun, where the fusion is in the atmosphere, the pinch effect to ignite this. And so when they get out to Jupiter, I recognized that Jupiter was a small star, ignited, etc., as was Saturn, and the redshift effects, etc. I've talked about the Marconi oscillators and the explanation for the solar corona and the symmetry of galaxies. Also, all of the problems with weather on planet Earth. And I'm out of time. I'll pick up this topic next week. And next week, I will start the Cornell years, 5 programs. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.